My name is Christopher. My day job is at the University of Wisconsin. And I guess I am supposed to tell you about explorations in dynamical systems. Right? And I have been warned that most of you are interested in cosmology, quantum field theory, etc. And so you may wonder, why do I have to learn this? Well, you don't have to learn anything, first of all, as you know. But there are two reasons, okay? So there are two different reasons for studying dynamical systems. And the first one, which I'm going to go on a little bit about, is a conceptual one of why it's an interesting field of physics, but extremely difficult. And it's this conceptual thing of, we're so used in physics to thinking about things that are in thermal equilibrium, where there's this enormous simplification where you say, if I can compute the energy of all the states of the system, then I can compute all of its properties. And the difficulty of doing that computation is real and important, but it's not a conceptual problem. You say, well, if I could do this calculation, I would be done. And you know, I do condensed matter physics, and so much of condensed matter physics is our failure of being able to do that calculation, and a lot of string theory is a failure to be able to do that calculation. But in principle, you know what it is you should be doing. You don't know how to do it, but you know what you should be doing. And in dynamical systems theory, we actually don't know what we should be aspiring to. All right? And there are little glimpses. And so the point of the course at some level is to tell you these little glimpses of there is something to understand and explain, and there is something sort of the physicists would consider respectable that one can do in the field. But it's the agenda is not laid out in the same way. And I'm going to argue a little bit in this lecture, which is the hand-wavy bullshit lecture, as we say, that really important problems fall into the class of things where these new concepts that we're hoping to develop will really have a lot of importance in a lot of areas, extending well beyond the usual purview of physics. Okay, so that's thing number one, which I'll talk a little bit about in this lecture, and then towards the end, towards the end, you'll be very disappointed because I won't actually have a lot of good answers for you. Okay, then the other reason. So assuming you don't want to, if you're not interested in that, that's fine. I'll be very disappointed, but it's fine. But the other reason is it turns out that what I'm going to do for certainly the first part of the course, probably the first week or two, it depends on how it goes, I'm going to tell you about some work sort of circa 1980 on one case where great progress was made, and it turns out that, again, the point being, that you can understand complex systems even if you don't know exactly the equations that govern them. Okay, and the fact that that is possible in one example is what gives people hope that really, you know, sort of the concepts of physics could be applicable even in situations where we don't have the fundamental equations. Okay, that's sort of the key point. And I'll go through one example, and it turns out it's sort of the purest example, in my opinion, of the renormalization group, which underlines everything you're doing. It underlines all of field theory, much of statistical mechanics, this idea of sort of general symmetries determining fundamental properties of physical systems. And it turns out that this one case of the transition to chaos in the logistic map, which I will explain to you, is sort of the mathematically least complicated example of a renormalization group that one can that has been constructed, right? And so I'm going to take you through that. And so even if you have no interest in dynamical systems and no interest in the population biology model that gave rise to the studies of the logistic map, it might be of interest to you just because it's this very clean example of the concepts of the renormalization group that are sort of independent of all the mathematical complications of actually doing a partition sum, which, you know, or, you know, computing an action, all right? And therefore, I think it's really useful pedagogically because it really helps you understand what goes into a renormalization group calculation and what comes out, and why there is universality in the sense that you don't need to know detailed equations, but rather you just need to know fundamental symmetry. Okay, so that's the overall why I think you should wake up early. Okay, all right. So that's the thing. And so now I'm just going to give you my view. Again, take a few minutes to give you my view of why, in particular, I sort of decided to cover this material. And let me look at my notes. See if I want to make sure I did it right. Okay. I did that part. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about the difference between equilibrium and non-equilibrium systems. And then I'm also going to talk about some recent work, actually, in the economics and computer science communities that sort of lead me to believe that that this is going to be an area in the future. So there's this famous quote, you know, prediction is difficult, particularly of the future. And I went on the internet and I decided to see who said it. And it turns out it's either Yogi Berra, Niels Bohr, or Mark Twain. Okay. And what's interesting, if you go, you can Google this thing. And if you go, they just say, well, as Yogi Berra said, or as Mark Twain said, but no one ever gives you the actual reference. So based on dates, I think that if I could find Mark Twain said it, then obviously he would be first, right? Because he died before either Niels Bohr or Yogi Berra did anything. And then if he didn't say it, then obviously Niels Bohr said it, unless he didn't say it, in which case Yogi Berra said it. Okay. Anyway, but I wanted to give you some idea of, this is sort of my prediction of why this field is going to become important in the immediate future. Okay. So again, I was talking again before at the very beginning about the difference between thermal equilibrium and not in equilibrium. All right, and again, whenever you do statistical mechanics or whenever you do sort of anything, typically what you do is you write down an energy functional and then you figure out what's going on. Or when you do field theory, you write down an action and then you're sort of computing an action. An action is, again, it's sort of like you have some system in however many dimensions, okay, and when there's some number that this configuration has, and you're summing over all possible configurations, and for each configuration there is a number, and the probability of achieving that configuration is determined by a single number, which we call the energy or the action or whatnot. Anyway, and the point is the history doesn't matter, okay, and so that's sort of the key thing here is that. The dynamical evolution of what happened is irrelevant, that there's like one number that tells you what the state is, okay? And so I'm going to stick to statistical mechanics because it's what I know. I mean, I know condensed matter physics, statistical mechanics, so I'm not going to talk about field theory because I know less about it than you do at this point. I took it in graduate school, but my statute of limitations has expired. Okay, so the point is that you don't care how you got there, because if you wait long enough, there's a state that you reach, okay? And this is sort of postulated, but the evidence is very strong that there are lots and lots of situations in which this is a good approximation. Now, it turned out there are lots and lots of situations where this is not a good approximation. And so one of the things I study in great detail are disordered materials. And there it turns out that, for instance, in glass, the glass is not in a thermal equilibrium. If you wait long enough, any glass will eventually crystallize, right? But you may need to wait the age of the universe. And certainly you need to wait thousands of years. And if you need to wait thousands of years, it doesn't really matter that it hasn't reached equilibrium. It's the state you're always going to see. And so even though there is this sort of platonic other state that in principle you will reach if you wait long enough, it doesn't matter, right? Because you're never going to see it while you're alive. All right. And so understanding what a glass is, it turns out, is a much more difficult problem than understanding what a crystal is. Because a crystal is a state that's in thermal equilibrium and a glass is not. And you can look, and people have been arguing about glasses for, I don't know, however many hundreds of years. And certainly, for the last 80, 90 years, it's been a reasonably respectable problem. And There's a famous quote that by Phil Anderson, who's a Nobel Prize, famous Nobel Prize winner, saying, well, the glass problem is going to be, you know, the great problem of the next decade. And I think he said it 20 years ago. And but still, just people don't agree. Okay, and the reason why people don't agree is because it's not in thermal equilibrium, and it's not even known like when you'll know when you've solved the problem. Okay, so that's an example. But then other examples, and the thing are basically more dynamic. So, for instance, the problem of economies. Okay, and this is actually what got me interested. There have been sort of issues with the economies. With the world's economy lately, and it turns out that, you know, in the course of reading about this, I was reading about other things, and it turns out there are again fundamental problems with economic theory that it turns out are again more complex, and sort of this question of, you know, is there sort of an equilibrium state, or is the thing inherently unstable, it's a real question, and there's been recent progress that leads me to think that it might be amenable to study using dynamical systems theory. Okay, and then of course there's like the weather, you know, this question of, you know, is there climate change or is it the intrinsic variability, and how do you decide, and these are important questions, and again, whether a physics type approach where we're not trying to model every detail of everything but yet trying to get something more general out is relevant, I think, is going to come to the fore again. All right, and so that's okay. So the point is that if you're not in equilibrium, then it's in principle a very difficult problem, because it's not just like you know you can figure out all the different configurations, but the energy functional doesn't tell you anything. So even in systems where there is an energy functional, if you're not in equilibrium, it's not just, oh, if we find the lowest energy state, then that's the most probable. You don't know that to be true. And in fact, I depending on how things go, I can give you an explicit example where it's not true. I know for sure it's not true because we know enough about the system to say, oh, okay, well, here's this thing, it's on equilibrium, but we know where it goes, and we know that the state that you reach is the highest energy state possible. Okay, I have an example of that. Okay, and so that isn't always true. I mean, sometimes you hit a low, but we don't know the principle that tells you what state you reach. Okay, and that's the point. So you have this, you know, in principle, horrendous problem of, oh, okay, well, you've got, you know, so even if you do know the fundamental equations, which you don't always know, but let's say we know them because, you know, we want to start somewhere, you know, you say, okay, well, but now I need to know where I started, what the dynamics were, you know, and it just seems completely intractable. And again, the miracle of what I'm going to tell you is sometimes, even though it doesn't do the simple thing of doing a quasi-equilibrium thing, something that looks like equilibrium, it will still do something that you can understand in detail, you can make quantitative predictions about, you can say when they're valid, you can test them experimentally, and that's sort of the miracle of the whole thing. Okay, so that was that. Okay, so now, again, before I get going, I wanted to say one more thing about my motivation for covering this material in the course. All right. And that is, so the first part of the course is going to be about, you know, greatest hits of, you know, universality and the transition to chaos that was developed in around 1980. But then, assuming I get through that material, I will then tell you a little bit about game theory. Okay. So, and game theory is very respectable. It was developed sort of in the 20s and 30s by John von Neumann, who's a very famous guy. So the computer architecture that we use in our computers is called the von Neumann architecture, so he developed that. He did very important work on fundamentals of quantum mechanics. So I guess you heard a course on fundamentals of quantum mechanics. You might have heard some of his, about some of it. So he did work on, you know, entropy in quantum systems, and he wrote a famous book on fundamentals of quantum mechanics. But it turns out in the 20s and 30s, he wrote, he was very interested in studying economic systems. And he developed what's known as game theory. And the point of game theory is it's the interaction of agents who aren't, so let's talk about Newton's laws for a sec. So you have Newton's laws where, you know, I'm here and, you know, I'm a particle and I have, you know, a mass, and let's say I'm in there's damping. We'll even allow there to be damping. But the point is, I'm subjected to forces, and if you know the forces that I'm subjected to, you know where I'm going, okay? And it's sort of, it's, you know, that's my rule, okay? I see that, you know, I'm getting pushed this way, and I go that way. All right, but in an economy, it's a little different, where he says, well, I'm here, and I'm trying to maximize this thing called utility, okay? And utility is just something you make up, which is, you know, how much I want something. So, you know, I go in the store, and, you know, do I buy an Apple or do I buy a PC? And the PC costs less money, but the Apple's more trendy, and not, the wireless works better or whatever. And so which one do I buy? And so you're giving up money, right, but you're getting this thing called utility, and then the amount you're willing to spend depends on this utility. And you know it when you see it because you've gone into the store and bought the more expensive shampoo, right? Okay. But the point is that you're interacting with other people or other agents or companies or whatever, and they're maximizing their utility too. And so, you know, sort of the price that Apple can charge for a computer depends on how much other people are willing to spend, okay? And so the point is that it's, you know, I have my thing and I'm subject to what looks like a force, but the force that I'm subjected to is actually determined by the utility of all, you know, what other people decide is in their best interest, what maximizes their utility. And so the equations are sort of fundamentally more complicated because each, you know, there's this sort of individual optimization thing happening, okay? And game theory is now a pretty big thing in economics, and it's sort of used to model auction systems and, you know, and economies altogether. And it turns out that one of the fundamental theorems in game theory is a thing called Nash's theorem, which is, it says, well, you have a situation where everybody's trying to optimize utility, and sort of how much Apple is getting for their thing depends on how much we're willing to spend, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a thing called a Nash equilibrium, which says that there is a strategy, you know, sort of a set of actions that one can have that locally everybody's doing the best they can, that anyone changing their strategy will make them all worse off, or make that person worse off. So everybody is motivated to stay where they are. And so the idea is that economies reach, you know, that if you view this as a model of an economy, you'll reach equilibrium. Okay, so this is why I went on about equilibrium before, right? Because in physics we say, oh, well, if you wait long enough, you'll reach equilibrium, all right? And so the idea is that you have these things called rational agents, and they know what everybody should be doing. And, you know, what everybody, you know what, that everybody wants to pay less and get more, and that you say, I'm going to do what's best for me, given that everyone else is going to do what's best for them. And there is an equilibrium, and the existence of that equilibrium is what is proven by Nash's theorem. Okay. But now, recently, just in the last few years, and again, this is sort of amazing at some level, that computer scientists have pointed out that finding the net, I mean, it's true that there is a mathematical theorem that an Nash equilibrium always exists, but finding it is computationally intractable. Okay, and again, now, how many of you know about, you know, computational intractability? A few of you. Okay, so I think a few of you will be bored on one thing, because I think it's so important to understand what that word means that maybe tomorrow at the beginning of the lecture, I'll just give you a few things about computational intractability. Okay, but what it means from the at this qualitative hand-wavy, we're not going to call it bullshit now, we'll call it hand-wavy. At the hand-wavy level, what it means is that even though in principle an equilibrium exists, in practice, you can never find it because you don't have the computational resources that will enable you to find Nash equilibrium. Okay, so the point is that the fact that it exists, it turns out, is completely irrelevant. It's exactly like the glass problem, right, where we know if you wait long enough, the glass turns into a crystal, but it's totally irrelevant for looking out the window because it doesn't happen on a timescale that's at all relevant. And so it's exactly the same thing has happened in economics, where it is now known, again, fairly recently, that Nash equilibrium is not what happens. Okay. Now, and it's actually a matter of great debate now what the right concept is. Is that a question? Yeah.
So you mentioned that we assume that people try to maximize their utility.
Yeah.
Do you think that's sort of a valid assumption? Because sometimes people might not know what is the best.
Well, that's exactly, in some sense, that's the point. You're doing the best you can, but you know you don't know, right? And the fact that you know you don't know, it turns out, is that that's the point of the intractability of the problem. Is that we know we don't know, but they say, well, but other people know. Okay, but turns out nobody knows. And the intractability of the computation of an action equilibrium is exactly that statement. That it's not just that you realize you're, I mean, sometimes you know. I mean, you know, there's sort of the generic brand shampoo, and then there's the, you know, the name brand shampoo, and you can either decide you're going to buy the one or the other, and that's, you see what I mean? That's not, it's a problem that we solve, right? We pick one. Okay, but the general problem, it turns out not only do we know that often we don't know what we're doing, but it turns out that it's absolutely inevitable. If you believe in, again, modulo the sort of, the computational complexity assumptions. And I'll talk about next time a little bit just because it's so important for you to know. Okay, and that's a point that's fundamental. So that's exactly the point. That up till now would be sort of like, well, right, lots of times we go, and there's this thing called limited rationality, which says that, well, we don't really know, and we'll just sort of fake it, and maybe it doesn't matter. But that's exactly the same statement as well. Well, you know, we're not in thermal equilibrium, but we'll just compute as if we are, and maybe it doesn't matter. You see, it's exactly the same thing. Okay. And so right now, actually, there's, you know, huge debate about what the right thing to do in economics is, given that Nash equilibrium is a totally irrelevant, at some level, an irrelevant concept, because you can't reach it. Okay. And so the question is, in economics as well, what do you want, you know, so there it seems that, you know, one of the questions is, well, there are two things that I've, and just so you know, I'm reading about this. I find this a really interesting thing to realize that all of a sudden there's this great unknown. Okay, and I'm not going to give you any, you know, I find it interesting. I think this is going to be a, you know, interesting and fundamental problem for the future, but I don't have great things to tell you. It's a few little things I found in the literature and whatnot, but I can certainly tell you about the basics and, you know, but I wanted to tell you why I think it's interesting right now, obviously. Okay, so the thing is that one thing that people do is they say, well, okay, well, you know, maybe they're not maximizing utility. So one of the things that they talk about is minimizing regret. And it's a weaker notion. It's sort of this thing of saying, well, if to maximize utility, it's sort of you need to know what everybody else is doing or whatever. But then they say, well, okay, well, you know, that's not possible. Maybe it's like, well, if I pick another strategy and it's only a little worse than what I could have done doing something else, maybe that's good enough. And it turns out if you weaken the notion of what you mean, then you can, you know, there are things that you can say. But the other possibility is, and this is the one I believe in, okay, and I should say that all of this is just based on, you know, going to the store and, you know, sort of my, you know, how I feel about myself when I'm trying to make, you know, economic decisions, is I think, well, what happens is you just sort of make these decisions based on some dynamics. So again, now we're back to where we were in dynamical systems, what I was talking about before, that in principle, you know, the thing depends on, you know, the dynamical rules, and in which case then there is this hope that maybe there will be general things that come up that don't depend on every detail, and yet we can say something like, when are you prone to oscillations? When are you prone to chaotic behavior, et cetera, et cetera? Okay, and so that's why I decided it was a really interesting thing to tell you about now, even though the work I'm going to tell you about in the first 2 weeks is, you know, from 30 years ago. You know, I think that, again, because of these this new context of understanding that there's this fundamental problem in game theory that it is now known that that equilibrium is not in practice. Or in principle is not reachable, and maybe in practice things sort of do equal. You know that, okay, but we don't know, and it's sort of known that in principle you can't reach equilibrium. What's the right concept instead? And I think that's going to be an important question. Certainly in economics and in computer science. And again, whether physicists have something useful to bring to it, I don't know. Okay, but that's why I'm covering it. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. Are there any questions about this? And if you're all bored, then I can take 3 weeks off and visit beautiful Waterloo. Okay, so then I'll get started. Okay, so again, what I'm going to do is, again, first probably 2 weeks, I'll tell you about dynamical systems theory in a model that's like so simple that you would be sort of hard-pressed to believe that people could earn a living studying. Okay, so. Now, what I'm going to talk about, again, for the next bit, we don't know exactly. We'll see how it goes. And also, again, the point is, again, we don't think this is your main line of work. So if I do things that sort of assume knowledge you don't have, you should stop me. If I confuse you, which is a specialty of mine, you should stop me, and you know, because there's no point to it if you're not understanding what's going on. Okay, so what we're doing is we're sort of going backwards from Newton's laws. So, and again, we're going to think of it purely classically. There's not going to be any quantum mechanics in anything I'm going to tell you. Now, you can add quantum mechanics later, and there's a field called quantum chaos, and there's all sorts of interesting quantum dynamics having to do with quantum computing, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm happy to tell you about that at some other time, but none of that is going on here. Okay, so we're just going to talk about classical mechanics. Okay. Okay, and the reason is why this is a good place to start is because with classical mechanics, we think we know what we're talking about. Like quantum mechanics, we know is unintuitive and things happen and we don't understand them, et cetera, et cetera. But classical mechanics, we think we got. You know, you have something or other, and you have a mass, and then there's some equation of motion, and if you know your initial velocity and your initial position, you got this rule, and that's all there is to it. Okay, and so you have sort of some xipi now. That's supposed to be an n. Okay. And then you have xi and you have pi for all future times. It's just a rule. Okay. And that's an example. But actually, you know, classical mechanics is sort of complicated, right? Because there's momentum and position. And for purposes of this course, there's three dimensions. And that's way too many, okay? And so you say, well, but you can make other rules. All right? And so if you're going to study sort of general things of rules, why not look at the simplest rule you can? And so the simplest thing you can do is just sort of, you know, just have one variable. Okay. And that's sort of the principle here, is you're just looking at the simplest possible thing. And again, the miracle of the whole thing, and why we're interested at some level, is it turned out that, you know, and I should say that when Feigenbaum, I'm going to tell you about Feigenbaum's work, okay? And when Feigenbaum started looking at this, it was, you know, completely not intellectually respectable, okay? But with the benefit of hindsight, it turns out that, you know, the stuff that happens with the really, really simple rule turned out to be quite generally applicable. And at the end of the story, you can say specifically what the regime of applicability is. But at the beginning, you just say, well, I've got this, you know, idiotic equation with one variable, and we don't know what it means. And, you know, and so, I'll tell you one story. Again, all of this is umpteen tan. But the story was, okay, so he was there, and he had This all happened right when calculators first came out. I know this sounds like it's not possible, but I was actually alive when calculators first came out. But they were hugely expensive, right? You know, so I remember it was like my freshman year in college, I saw my first calculator, and it was like an HP something or other, which really didn't do much, but it was like almost $1,000, and there was a guy and he, like, you know, he drilled a hole in his desk and had a chain for his calculator, right? You know. Anyway, so Feigenbaum got a hold of this calculator, and so he, you know, he wanted something to do with this calculator, and so that's why he started studying this equation. Anyway, and so he did what I'm gonna tell you about over the next 2 weeks, and he sent it off to Physical Review Letters, which is, you know, sort of a well-known physics journal, and it, you know, was immediately rejected. And so if you look, all the there are sort of these two famous papers, and they're published in the Journal of Statistical Physics because it wasn't physics. Anyway, so there you go. And basically what happened was the referee's report, again, all of this is just something canned gossip, but I have no doubt it's true. Was, you know, well, this equation is so simple and so stupid, it can't possibly be physics. And so then he went back and actually, you know, showed that it worked for, you know, a whole, he picked one equation, which I'll write down, I promise, in a minute. And so then he went and he did other equations. So we're actually going to make you do other equations, because the whole thing was rejected. Like, you know, who cares about this map? It's so simple and stupid. But then he showed that, you know, the universal behavior that he found, that, you know, was the point of all of this, actually applies to a whole bunch of equations. And it turns out that later on it was, you know, proven rigorously that it's not just one-dimensional maps that it applies to, but it applies to, you know, a whole class of dynamical systems. And again, it's and from the point of view of mathematicians love, and again, these notes that apparently scared a lot of you. I'm not going to, in case you didn't notice, I'm not going to do mathematically rigorous. They're actually not that hard if you get into the swing of them. But the mathematicians love this because they can actually prove that the renormalization group works, and the procedure converges, and there's universality, and all of the things that often in physics we sort of think are true and we really all believe that are not mathematically proven to be true, it turns out are all proven to be true for this particular situation. Okay, and so again, from the point of view of the renormalization group, it's fantastic because a lot of things that, you know, we believe to be true in the more general context, we know to be true in the simple context. Okay, so basically, here's step one, is that, you know, you forget Newton's laws, they're too complicated, let's just write a simple equation. And so the actual equation is, so then you write an equation which is xi plus 1 is equal to f of xi. Okay, and so then the idea is you're given x0, and then you're given f, all right, and then if you're given f, you're given x0, and then you're given f, and then you got that rule, and then you get x1, and then you're given x1, and then you plug it in, and you get x2, and that's all there is to it. And again, it's exactly conceptually what you do with Newton's laws, right? You take your initial positions. Only here, these are differential equations, but you could just set up a clock and just sort of look like every second, say, and say, well, I started now, and then, you know, at time zero, my positions and velocities or whatever, and then I go for 1 second, and now they have the value at 1 second, and then I go for 2 seconds. So conceptually, it's exactly the same. The fact that I'm looking at discrete equations is irrelevant from the point of view of the concept. Okay, all right, and everything about our rule about the dynamics is an F. Okay, and I guess the thing is, you could say, well, what's F? Okay. And now the simplest choice for f, of course, is f is a constant, but that's not very interesting dynamics because all the x's are the same. And the second simplest thing is you could say, well, f is linear in x, and then again we have a complete solution, which is more or less completely uninteresting. It just goes linearly in time. And again, the big surprise is when you go to second order, the simplest nonlinear thing, all sorts of stuff happens. Okay, and so that's the case that Feigenbaum did. And what he did is, let's look at F, which is called the logistic map. And basically, F of x is equal to mu x 1 minus x. Okay, so again, why write this down? Because the absolute simplest case is trivial, and the linear case is trivial. It's the second most simple case, and then it turns out this is enough to be completely non-trivial, okay? And so it's the simplest non-trivial thing you can do. All right, so let me plot f of x. Here's x, here is f, and it looks like this, okay? And the relevant range just goes from 0 to 1, okay? And what do I want to say about it? Okay, it depends on mu. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. So the only thing that's not determined about this map is mu. All right. And it turns out that what's going to happen, that as you vary mu, different things happen. Okay. So again, I could just have, you know, mu x and forget the 1 minus x, and then what would happen would be completely independent of mu. Just, you know, it would, you know, you would just be mu to the n times x, and there's no qualitative change in behavior if it's linear. But it turns out when it's quadratic, as I vary mu, stuff happens. Okay. And again, then the biggest surprise at some level is it turns out that everything, there's nothing that you'd say, well, okay, well, then I'm doing this, and what if I made it cubic or quartic or whatever? And it turns out that everything I'm going to tell you, it doesn't matter, okay? That the map could be anything, and you'll get the same universal behavior, okay? And again, when you start, that's completely unobvious, okay? But that's, at some level, why we write down the laws of physics that we write down, why we write down simple actions and theories and whatnot, is because of the fact that, you know, there are these things that happen where you write down a simple form and the higher order terms don't affect the behavior once you get to, you know, the first non-trivial order. Any further complication doesn't change anything further in a quantifiable way that will become clear. At least in this case, and again, where everything is rigorously kosher. Okay, all right, and so this is the map, and it looks like this. And so then, if you want, and again, this is not necessary, but it's very useful in terms of thinking about things. You can make an interpretation of it. Okay, so Feigenbaum did not come up with this map. This map was developed by population biologists, and it was just the simple model of a population dynamics. Okay, and so the point is that here you have a situation where so here's a simple interpretation, and again, it was a map of population dynamics. Again, not very well accepted because it was so simple, but again, the fact that it's good for that some aspects of it are completely general was not known at the time. Okay, so the interpretation is that X is a population of generation J. Okay. Okay, and so the picture is that if X is little, then there's lots of food, and then the population goes up. Okay, so xj plus 1 is greater than xj if x is small. Okay, but then you start here and the population goes up and up, and then if x is big enough, then everybody gets crowded and they start arguing over the food and they don't have enough food, and then the population goes down. Okay. Either that or they all start playing video games. We're not sure which. Okay. But anyway, but then xj plus 1 is less than xj if x is large. Okay. And it's normalized to 1. So basically, this is a population of j, you know, divided by some maximum population. Okay. And again, you can imagine population biologists, you know, arguing over the concept of maximum population, but we won't, okay? You just say, well, okay, it's just some function that goes up when it's little and goes down when it's big, okay? And so then the idea is you just have this thing, and then again, it's a discrete model, so you want to think about, you know, wasps or something, your 7-year cicadas or whatnot. You know, they all go, and then they run around, and then they, you know, and they lay their eggs, and then they all die, and then the next generation comes, and you want to know how many come up in the next generation, okay? And if there's lots of food and they all run around and procreate, then you get more, and if they don't find enough food, then they don't, and they die without more, and that's the model, okay? All right. And actually, it was known, I guess, in the 50s and whatnot that you know, this doesn't settle down. Okay, so again, going back to this equilibrium concept, you'd say, well, it's an equation. It's a pretty simple equation. And, you know, and in principle, you could imagine that, you know, if you look at it the right way, maybe it'll just settle down to some behavior and reach sort of some equivalent of equilibrium, okay? And in some sense, you know, it doesn't. I'll show you. I mean, and you'll be stuck doing a lot of this for yourself, because the thing about this equation is it's so simple that, you know, it's, you know, sort of trivial to simulate, and you'll be stuck simulating it. Okay, and but the point is, okay, in some sense it doesn't, because it never settles down, and you'll see you get very complicated temporal behavior at arbitrarily long times. Okay, but in some other sense it does. Okay, and in that sense, it's, you know, because there's also this question of the initial condition. Remember I said that, you know, in principle the whole thing could depend on the initial condition. Turns out for this particular map, now this isn't true for all systems, but in this one, it turns out it's particularly simple because, and this is one of the things that these notes that really scared a lot of people based on what Dennis said, that's what he goes to great lengths to prove. Okay, that it turns out that the fact that you don't know where you started is an irrelevant complication for this thing, because it turns out the long time behavior does not depend on where you start, except for a set of measure zero. Okay, and again, what's great about the logistic map is that, you know, all these things are proven and mathematically rigorous and whatnot, but, you know, we're not going to prove all of them, so don't be scared. Okay, but it turns out that the initial condition is not important for this map. Okay, and but it turns out that the qualitative change in the dynamics is important, and that's what we're going to focus on. Okay, so okay, so the whole trick is we want to find out what happens when you change mu. Okay, and again, hopefully I have set up to the point where, you know, it looks so simple, but there is something there. I think. Is this okay here? That's okay? All right. All right, so let's see, I've got 5 minutes. I'm trying to think where a good place to stop is. But I think I'd, what? Oh, it's 55. Oh, it's 5 past the 5 till. I got it. Yeah, now I'm used to the hour to the 10 till. Okay, so in that case, I can get started. Okay, so I've set up the thing. Is it all clear? Okay. All right, and so now what I want to do is to talk about the bifurcation diagram. Okay. Okay, and okay, so first, I should tell you, when I first learned about this, I was very worried about what the term bifurcation meant. So what a bifurcation is, it means it splits in two, okay? And now it turns out it's slightly more general than that. But what happens in our case is actually it splits in two, all right? So I'll tell you a little bit about that. So basically, you set, and again, you'll be doing this, okay? So here is xj, all right? And you start it off somewhere. And again, it's possible to start it off at a non-generic point. But if you sort of pick a few points and avoid a half, and 0 and 1, typically you'll end up at what I'm telling you. Or you just try a few points, okay, whatever. And then again, that's this wonderful thing about the initial conditions not coming, okay? So what happens is that if mu is small enough, and here we have mu is less than 1, what happens is you just go and x, you end up at x equals 0 and you just stay there, okay? Then, if mu is 1 is less than mu, and mu is less than or equal to 3, what happens is that you start off at some random mu, and then you still go to some value, but the value is no longer 0. Okay? And then, when 3 is less than mu, which is less than, I think, oops, I didn't write it down here, but it has like a 1 and a square root of 6. Just a minute. Did I write it down? I'll call it mu 1, which I think is 1 plus square root of 6, but I'm not sure. Okay. Then what happens, and now this is where you get bifurcation. What happens is, you know, you start off, you do whatever, and then your orbit goes up and down and up and down and up and down like this, okay? And then you get a period 2 orbit. Okay. All right. So that's too low, isn't it? Here, let me put it over here. Okay. So again, there's some transient. Okay. Which I'll go like, I'll do this. Okay. But it goes like this. Okay. Okay. So, and this is what you want to think of with the bifurcation. So I was being sort of pedantic here. Let me get rid of this. All right, this is 3 less than or equal to mu, less than or equal to mu 1. Okay, all right. Okay, and so this is what you mean by a bifurcation. The orbit splits in two in the sense that instead of repeating every time, it repeats every other time. Okay, so the fact that these are period 1 orbits. Okay, and then this is a period 2 orbit. Okay, and so the bifurcation is, I mean, that it's the orbit, the you know, the period changes, so the orbit splits into, okay? And now it turns out that, and you know, because bi is 2 and whatever. Okay, now it turns out there are other types of bifurcations, and the term is used in a lot of other different ways of changing the orbits. And in a typical course in dynamical systems, what would happen is we would go through all the different ways that orbits could change and whatnot. But I'm not going to do that to you, partly because, again, the goal of the thing was to, you know, be able to show you how the renormalization group works and the scale invariance. And the fact that you can get that at different kinds of bifurcations, I think, is sort of a detail that I decided I'm not so interested in covering. I just want to do this one case from beginning to end. But there are different kinds of bifurcations, okay? So, all right, so I have 5 minutes. So I guess what I'll do is I'll start going into how I know this is true. Okay, yeah.
You said that xi plus 1 is a function of xi.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, you could get to a certain x, a certain population, either while you're increasing or you're decreasing.
Yes.
So how do you know?
Well, in this equation, you don't know. Okay, so that's a great question in the sense of, okay, this is a model that I just wrote down, right, where the population the next time depends only at the previous time and doesn't care about what happened before. And in a sense, this is why no one took the model seriously. Well, it should matter, doesn't it? Okay. But the point of the universality is that I could write a more complicated equation, okay? But generically these equations have these sort of period doubling instabilities. And what happens is that what you're gonna see is that the period 2 is gonna double, and there's gonna be period 4, and then period 8, period 16, and there's going to be scaling behavior associated. And that scaling behavior does not matter. I could make the model more realistic, and the scaling behavior would stay the same. So in some sense, that's the whole point, that you look at this model and you're like, oh my god, this model is dumb. Okay? But it's missing all this important physics. And yet, it doesn't matter because there are certain aspects that don't depend on the physics. So it depends on, you know, just very qualitative aspects of the physics. And so you could make the model more realistic. And so basically what you could do, and you know, when people do this all the time, okay, is I say, well, here I have f, I have x, I plus 1. And it could be, well, I won't call it f, I'll call it g. No, I don't want to call it g because I'm going to use g. I'll call it capital F, okay? It would be some other function of xi, xi minus 1, xi minus 2, say. Okay, and this makes it much more analogous to Newton's laws, where if it was xi and xi minus 1, then you have an approximation to the momentum, right? And so if I just pick 2, I'm good, right? The point being, though, that what you'll see, and again, we're only going to get this at the end, is that the universality says that it doesn't, that the exponents don't depend. I could do that, and I would get the same exponents because they're, and again, it's completely unobvious. That's why it's going to take a little while to get to the end. The fact that that is true is completely unobvious when you start, that it doesn't matter if you make your equation better. And again, that was why when Feigenbaum sent his paper to the school review letters, it was like immediately bounced without a second thought. Because they're like, well, who cares about this equation? It's so dumb. Okay. And what makes it interesting is the fact that you could come up with a more realistic equation and it would give you the same exponents. Okay. The exponents are non-trivial and they apply to this huge class system. So let me just give you the analogy in terms of the step map that you already had, is that, you know, so when I guess Professor Chernoff was here, and he was doing all these spin models, and he wrote down a Hamiltonian of spins, and he said, oh, and there are phase transitions, and there are universal exponents. Well, the point is that the model, the interactions between the spins, I mean, they're not the right interactions. I mean, you know, these are real electrons and materials, and complicated, and there are relativistic effects, and but it turns out that none of that matters. Okay, and again, this is the simplest, purest example of, you know, even if you don't have the right equations, you can still make quantitative statements. And that's what makes universality so powerful. Okay, I really feel like I answered your question. Do you feel like I answered your question?
Thank you.
Okay, are there other questions? Okay. So let me just talk about the fixed points for a minute. Oh, and I have a little bit of space right here. Okay, and so the question is, all right, so let me just do this one first, because this one's easy, which is good. Okay, so let's just say here. Let me just go back to f of x is equal to mu x 1 minus x. Okay. Now, the point is that how to show that you end up always at a fixed point. All right. Now, when mu is less than 1, okay, f of x is less than mu x, okay? And there, everything is groovy, right? Because if f of x is less than mu x, then I have x j is less than or equal to mu to the j times x. Okay, you see what I did? Because, well, let me just do one. Okay, so x1 is equal to mu x0, less than or equal to mu x0. x2 is less than or equal to mu x1, which is equal to mu squared x0, etc. Okay, so when mu is small enough, it's just linear. It behaves the same way as a linear map does, in the sense it just zooms in, and there you go. Okay, so that's simple enough. Okay, but when mu is between when mu is bigger than one, then what happens is that when mu is equal to one, you can sort of look at this equation. You can sort of see like what happens here is if mu is equal to one, then this right hand side is still less than x, essentially. And then, again, so these Sternberg notes, again, go through the case when mu is equal to 1 and shows that it converges to x equals 0. Okay, so that's another thing. So when you read these notes, hopefully it's not scary. And again, it's a simple, all of the things in those notes are quite elementary once you know what it is he's trying to do. Okay. But he's a mathematician, right? And so, and what I wanted to do when I did those notes was to show you that, you know, the whole thing is intellectually respectable, where everything has been proven, even though I'm not going to prove it to you. Okay, but it is, and people have gone, and, you know, so everything I'm telling you is sort of rigorously justified. Okay, so that's a period one orbit, but then there's a second situation, which is a period one orbit, which is when mu is less than one. Mu is between 1 and 3, and I'll do that case, and then it looks like I should stop. Okay, and that's actually a really good point to stop. So, okay, the other this is the other fixed point, and so then the point is, if I'm looking for a fixed point, okay, then what I'm looking for is a solution to the equation x is equal to mu x 1 minus x. Okay, and one fixed point is at x equals 0. I just found it for you, right? Okay, and so the solutions are x equals 0, and then the other one is x is the solution of 1 is equal to mu times 1 minus x, and so that is x is equal to, let's see, 1 minus 1 over mu. Okay? And so that's the other fixed point, and the point is, if mu is less than 1, then this isn't in the range between 0 and 1, and you never see it because it's not in our allowed range. But when mu is bigger than 1, then it's in the allowed range, and you're good. Okay? And so this is the other fixed point. Okay. Now, the question is, and we'll do next time, is to say, well, those are the only fixed points, and so what, why is it that we see them only in this restricted range? And that has to do with the stability. So I'll go through stability next time, and then we'll do period doubling, and then in the tutorial, you'll just, you know, you're going to have to write little Mathematica programs, but they're really little. And in the notes that I did, I even write some of them for you. They're not complicated. And then you get to sort of play and draw graphs, and it's all very nice. Okay, are there any other questions? All right, see you tomorrow. Oh. Go.
Okay, yeah, one thing I forgot to mention, Zhao Gang Wen's flight is delayed, and so he's not going to show up until the end of the day. And so then the question arose, what to do about his lecture. It turns out that Ruth Gregory, it works for her if she does an extra lecture today. So the second and third lectures will be by Ruth Gregory, and then Wen will get an extra lecture later on in the course. So his condensed matter will start tomorrow. And today, as I said, there's two gravitational physics lectures.
So to add to what John has said, however, you're going to have today the condensed matter tutorial. because as the material covered during the tutorial is quite simple, and I'm pretty sure that it will not be the problem for you. So today you are going to have all three tutorials on dynamical systems, on condensed matter, and most likely on cosmology, not the photographer, the gravitational physics. I constantly confuse these two things. Anyway, any questions about the tutorials, what we're going to do in the afternoon? We'll probably start with condensed matter and gravitational physics, because the majority of you have registered for these two courses. Any questions? Okay.